If you ache for truth, goodness, and beauty, if you're hungry for a Christianity with substance and strength, if you long for a faith that's big and bold and biblical and all about Jesus Christ, if you're inspired by the idea of one church that has spanned 20 centuries, 24 time zones, and two hemispheres, enfolding every race, nation, and language, then you're considering Catholicism. Well, welcome back to the Considering Catholicism podcast. My name is Greg, and I'm your host, and I am here with...
Ed the Protestant,
drum roll. Now, I feel like compelled to start today by complimenting your sweater. Because I was kind of harsh in our last couple of episodes because I was very critical of the fact that you were a delicate flower that couldn't operate, you know, outdoors in anything less than 75 degrees. And then I criticized your lumberjack shirt. And so it came to my attention that I'm just like, you know, kind of beaten around Ed the Protestant like a pinata.
Yeah.
So I resolved today to be a better man, to be a better Catholic, to be a better follower of Jesus, and compliment you to say, Ed, that sweater looks very nice on you.
Thank you. My Will Smith from Men in Black, and difference between me and you, I make this suit look good.
Yes, yes. You make that sweater look good. And it's perfectly okay if men sit around and compliment each other's things. Like, I think that probably is in your color palette.
Right.
It complements your complexion very well.
I had my color analyzed. You know, that's four seasons, you know, you're a summer or a winter or fall, whatever.
Okay.
I had my color analyzed one year, and I am that 1 week right after Labor Day where you're not supposed to wear white, but it's still warm and nobody knows what to wear. That's the analysis there.
Well, Ed, I think you look very sharp, and the sweater sets off your eyes or something or other, and I really love it. And so this is my attempt to, you know, to be a better man.
Well, thanks, Greg.
You're welcome. Now I will point out that we are recording indoors today.
And I'm overdressed because I'm delicate.
Well, I didn't say that.
We come down here to whatever room this is, the kids, you know, Sunday school room or whatever. And in the past, when we've come down here, it's always been like 55 degrees in here. So I was standing, I got home from work and I took a shower and I'm getting dressed for, I come here and I'm thinking, what do I need? I need something warm because we're going to sit in that room. And
well, we couldn't be at the secret compound today because a spring snowstorm has blown in, and it's like extremely cold and snowy out there.
Right.
And I wouldn't be comfortable recording out there, and I know that you wouldn't be. Oh, I'm sorry. But anyway, look, just hard reset. Ed, sweater looks sharp. Your haircut looks sharp, and in all ways, you look sharp, and I'm just impressed. And I'm so glad that you could be with us today.
Now people are going to want a picture.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's nowhere to post it on the site, is there?
Oh, yeah, we could post a picture.
Let's not. Wait till I'm tan.
That's right. Okay, so today, Ed, we are going to respond to an email that we got. Actually, a couple of emails, a little email dialogue that I had with a listener. And she sent in a really great question. She kind of described her situation. Mm-hmm. And I want to answer her question on the air today.
Yep.
And then after that, I replied to her and she sent back a second email. And then as soon as we're done with this conversation, I want to reply to her second email.
Okay.
Okay. So we're going to call her Kate.
Okay.
That is not her real name, but we're going to call her Kate. And she is a 19-year-old woman. And seems really sharp and very, very bright person. She lives out west somewhere. Let's just leave it at that.
Okay.
Okay. So I'm going to summarize her first email, and then you kind of jump in. So Kate has a Baptist background, Southern Baptist primarily, is attending a Reformed Baptist church at the moment. And she met some Christian friends, one of whom is a devout Catholic. And so this group of friends began getting together to talk about God and church and theology. And in their friend group, they even did some Protestant versus Catholic like debate nights,
right,
where they kind of batted this stuff around, and the Catholic guy, you know, represented the Catholic position and Kate was representing the Protestant position. But the more she listened and learned, and the more she kind of researched on her own and read, the more she realized that everything that she thought that she knew about the Catholic Church was wrong. And she says that she has recently gone to adoration for the first time and Mass, and she's come to think that Catholicism is truly a beautiful and biblical religion, her words. She says, I found this podcast and I have found my misunderstandings and reservations explained away in a lot of regards, other than the social pressure or resistance that she's feeling from friends and family about converting to Catholicism. Mm-hmm. But the first question that she asks is this: how do we know that the Catholic Church is the church that Christ established? Is the scriptural support for this simply the Matthew 16:18 passage? I'll read that in a second. I'm sure you've heard both translations of this passage, and I feel like it's just an argument from authority no matter what side you look at. How did you, meaning me, get past this, you know, in my own conversion? So let me read that Matthew passage, and then that'll kind of set it up. This is the passage where Peter declares that Jesus is the Messiah. So people will be familiar with this, but let me just read it. It says that Jesus, when he came into the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, who do people say the Son of Man is? And they replied, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. But what about you, Jesus asked? Who do you say that I am? And Simon Peter answered, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And Jesus replied, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven. And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades, or hell, will not overcome it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Okay, so that's that famous passage, and it is one of the passages upon which the Catholic Church bases the doctrine of Petrine supremacy, meaning the supremacy of Peter over the other apostles, and the successors of Peter, meaning the bishops of Rome, the popes. And so, Kate is asking, how do we know that the Catholic Church, in a sense, is the true church that Christ established? And she hears Catholics citing this, and then she says, well, yeah, but my Protestant friends all say that Catholics are interpreting this passage wrong. So does it just come down to a he said, she said? You know, the Catholics say that it means that Peter is the rock upon which the church is built, and therefore, you know, the Pope and all that kind of thing, or Protestants who go, no, you've got it completely wrong. That's not what it means at all. So, Ed, I've been doing a lot of talking. What are your initial thoughts as somebody who is considering Catholicism?
Well, Kate, I grew up in the Baptist church too, although my understanding of it as Reformed Baptists are a little stiffer with all of this. So, Kate, I live in Protestant land, and I had a fairly high visibility job. I was doing the music at a big church here in our town, and there are not that many big churches here. So in the music world especially, and in, you know, people knew who I was. And for that reason, I've been doing this podcast for 2 years, and I'm pretty convinced. I mean, I'm convinced that I want to enter the Catholic Church, but I don't even talk about it on Facebook because it would just be flame wars. And, you know, so more than you know, or more than I'm telling anyway, it has been difficult. We've done a couple podcasts about my friends that I sat and had breakfast with, and they were, you know, one of them says, who thought that 40 years ago when we graduated from high school, or 50 years ago, that this would be, we'd be sitting here talking about this and that Ed would be talking about Catholics, you know? So, yeah, I was, the idea that the Catholic Church was the original church just didn't, I just didn't think of it that way.
So I think Kate's question, I want to try to answer it in a couple of different ways if we can. So jump in wherever you want to, Ed. So the question is, does the Catholic Church's claim to legitimacy just rest on an interpretation of this passage from Matthew that I read a minute ago?
Yeah.
About you are Peter and upon this rock and all of that, I think. Peter with the keys of the kingdom. And Kate alludes to the fact that Protestants have other interpretations of this passage. So here's my response to that challenge, if that's what it is, about the legitimacy of the Catholic Church as the church that Christ established. Let's start with this Matthew 16, 18 thing about you are Peter and upon this rock. Protestants have come up with at least three different explanations of this verse. And I don't want to spend a lot of time unpacking all of the Protestant explanations, right? I mean, one of them is that when Jesus says, you are Peter and upon this rock, what he means by the rock is Peter's faith.
Yes.
What I mean by the rock is Peter's faith. He says, you are the Christ, Son of the living God, on the rock of your faith. So anybody then who has that faith is the rock it's built
that
on.
That revelation that Jesus is the Christ.
Yeah, right. I mean, and so this is the faith alone Protestant thing that Peter may have been the first one to say it, but anybody who says that then has the rock upon which the church is built.
That's what I would have told you 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah. And there's some other ones. There's at least three of these. Another one is a tortured exegesis from the Greek that when he says, you are Peter, Petros, this little stone, but upon you, the chief cornerstone of the church, which is Jesus, will be built. Look, I don't want to spend time on this podcast unpacking the Protestant explanations. What I'd rather do is ask what I think is a better question, which is not how do Protestants explain it today, but how did the early church explain that verse, right? So if you think about the church fathers in the first three centuries, they spoke Greek.
Right.
Greek was their, biblical Greek was their native language. They lived in that culture, in that place. And they were only 1, 2, 3, 4 generations removed from the apostles.
Right.
So the question is not how do Protestants in the 16th century or in the 21st century want to interpret this verse, what kind of explanations that they can come up with and say, oh, no, this is what it means. And this is how, if you really understand it, my question is, well, let's go back and ask the people who spoke Greek, who lived there and knew the apostles, how they understood it. And here's the thing. If you go back to the early church, they all understood it to mean the primacy of Peter, that Peter was the rock upon which the universal Catholic Church was founded, that he was the chief of the apostles, and that he had a leadership capacity among the other apostles and the successors of the apostles, and this notion of apostolic succession through Peter.
Yep.
The various Protestant interpretations didn't come along for another 15 centuries or more.
Right.
Now think about that.
Right.
Again, for Protestants who say, oh, no, Catholics misunderstand the Greek. They misunderstand the cultural context. They misunderstand what it meant in those days. And you go, what are you talking about?
Because we all know better.
You're all coming up with these ideas 18, 19, 20 centuries later. Yeah. The people who all lived in the first century, the second century, the third century, all assumed it meant what it means, which is Petrine succession. 15 centuries later, I hate to use this word, but schismatics, because that's what the Protestants were schismatics. They come along, they're, again, 1,500 years removed by language, culture, and provenance, apostolic provenance from that passage. The early church understood it that way. So if we go back, for example, to around the year 100, there is a letter, the first letter of Clement, which Protestants don't like to talk about or don't talk about much, but Clement was the fourth bishop of Rome. So Peter was the first, and then there were two other guys, and then there was Clement. And by the way, a lot of those papacies didn't last a real long time because they were being persecuted and executed and all that. So Clement comes along around the year 100, and he writes a letter, Clement does, the bishop of Rome, to the church in Corinth, where Paul had written 1st and 2nd Corinthians, and he writes them a letter about another conflict, because the Corinthians were always having these conflicts. He writes them a letter about another conflict that they're having, and basically what he says is, as the Bishop of Rome, I instruct you XYZ.
Right.
Okay? So the thing is already by the 90s, when this is being written, this concept of the primacy of Peter and the primacy of the Bishop of Rome and Petrine's succession is understood and established. I mean, this is 30, 40 years after Peter and Paul die. Right. So again, the Protestants who want to get into the weeds on this and say, well, you just don't understand the biblical Greek, or you don't understand the culture or the context, you go, you're making something up 2,000 years later and reading it back in. But the people who were there,
right,
who spoke Greek, who lived in that time, lived in those places, knew those people, that's how they understood it. Now, let's be clear about something. To say that the early church understood the primacy of Peter as the Bishop of Rome and so forth does not mean that the institution of the papacy was fully formed from the beginning. The Catholic Church doesn't teach or believe that. There have been 2,000 years of organizational developments, canon law, etc. Here's an analogy. Think of, for example, the United States and the presidency.
Yeah.
So if we go back 250 years, the Constitution defined this office called the presidency. Remember who was the first president?
George Washington.
George Washington, right? And so it set up the presidency in the Constitution. It defined that role. But the presidency 250 years later has evolved, or at least it has evolved in all this complexity. It has cabinet officers, it has all these other roles and duties, and 250 years of law and development. Because one of the things Protestants will say is, oh, you can't go back and find the papacy looking like the papacy of the 19th or 20th century back in the first centuries. You go, of course not. But you do have the Bishop of Rome exercising authority and primacy as the successor of Peter with other bishops. And so that primacy is there, even though we have 2,000 years of development of the bureaucracy and the office and everything that surrounds it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So yeah, my first response to Kate's friends is the Matthew 16:18 passage. Yeah. I know that Protestants have other explanations, but that's not how the early church understood it. And I know that the Protestants will say, well, the papacy wasn't fully formed in the early church, but you know, that's sort of irrelevant. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Second thing I want to say is church history. There's a famous Catholic writer. He was actually a convert to Catholicism himself, an English theologian named John Henry Newman. He's now a saint, St. John Henry Newman. And when he began to study the early church, he converted from Anglicanism to Protestantism. And he has this famous line where he says, to be deep in history is to cease to be Protestant. Mm. And what he meant by that is that if you go back and study the early church, it isn't Protestantism. And this is what Protestants think, is that the early church looked more or less like Protestant denominations. And then somewhere along the way, the Catholic Church came and messed it up. And if we could only get back to the early church, it would look like Protestant denominations. And John Henry Newman and a million other scholars have gone back and go, well, no, let's go back and read those documents. Let's read the writers and study the history and all of the documents and whatnot from the first, second, third, fourth century. And guess what you find is that in the first, second, third, fourth century, the church was in all of its essential elements Catholic. Now, of course, it's grown and it's developed since then because living things grow and develop. But the Roman Catholic Church as we know it today is sort of contiguous with that early church in the same way that I look at Ed and I go, okay, well, five-year-old Ed didn't look like the current Ed,
right?
But he was the same person. If I go back and look at your high school graduation picture, I go, well, he's a younger version of Ed,
right?
And he doesn't have everything that Ed has now, but he's still Ed.
Right.
And in the same way, when we go back and look at the early church, what we find is it's contiguous with the Roman Catholic Church as we know it today. Yes, it's grown and it's developed, but in its infancy, all of the important elements.
Well, you can't go back and find anything that looks like the Baptist Church.
No.
And you would think that as hard as they pursued error, you know, the Manichaean errors and all these things, you would think that as hard as the church back then ferreted out these things and told them they were wrong and kicked these people out and wrote papers about it and all that, you'd think that if something like the papacy being wrong or the Peter being the bishop and passing it down, you'd think that they would have addressed that, but they never did.
No. So if you go back, all of the, what I said, the sort of essential qualities there, for example, at the Council of Nicaea, Okay. In 325, one of the lines in that, the Nicene Creed, is, I believe in one holy Catholic and apostolic church. So the question was, when the bishops of the world assembled at Nicaea in 325, and they said, I believe in a holy Catholic and apostolic church, did they mean some sort of Protestant understanding of it, where there's all these different denominations with different practices, and some baptize infants, and some baptize adults, and some speak in tongues, and some don't, and some believe in predestination, and some don't, and some worship this way, and some don't? What you find is that they had a notion that there was one church, and that all of these different, what we called our denominations, were sort of schismatics breaking up that one holy apostolic church. Mm-hmm. And now somebody's listening and they say, oh, well, that's at 325 at Nicaea, and that's when Constantine came along. But if you go back 100 or 200 or 300 years earlier, but you know, no dice. Because if you go back to those first church fathers writing shortly after the apostles died and into the, you know, 50, 60 years after that, 70 years after that, all essential elements. Again, it doesn't look like Roman Catholicism today. They didn't pray the rosary.
Right.
Okay. I'll give them that.
Right.
But all the essential elements of Catholicism are present. And what's not there is kind of proto-Protestantism, if that makes any sense. I mean, all of that comes along 1,200 years later. And then, you know, with Calvin and Luther and whatnot, and then it's been fiddled with for the last endlessly for the last 500 years. I was sitting with a Protestant minister friend of mine the other day having a beverage, and we were talking, and they said, oh, well, did you hear about such and such's church? And I said, I don't even know what you're talking about, right? I don't follow all that like I used to. And they're like, oh, it's this church out west, and they started doing this and this and this and this, and like they were doing some wacky things and some innovative things and like things doctrinally that were a little weird. And I'm like, what? And they're like, well, everyone's trying to decide whether it's okay or not okay. And are they good guys or are they bad guys? And I'm like, this endlessly making up new versions of the church and new versions of Christianity. I mean, there just was none of that in the early church. There was one holy Catholic and apostolic church.
Here in town, there's a particular denomination that has split maybe 100 years ago or more, and then it recently split. And now my mother-in-law, who belongs to one of these churches, says to me, oh, hey, our church is talking about joining this new coalition of churches. And it wasn't any of the, I'd never heard of it. It wasn't any of the ones that I knew of, even the recent ones. She said, here's a little bit about it. What do you think of this? And I wanted to say, well, it's just not Catholic. But I, you know, anyway.
Well,
so
I know the new alliance of churches you're talking about. And it's new, right. A new mini denomination.
Yes, exactly.
Because the other denomination was bad, but the denomination before that was bad. And again, we've talked about this on the podcast before. You know, you get to this situation where we're going to divide until in the end, the one true church is like 12 pastors, you know, meeting in a Holiday Inn in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. For their annual
convention.
there were like
15 churches in this thing, or 40 or something.
But they're the one true church now.
Well, yeah. Well, they're the one. The not so hidden subtext was, we have really hit on the thing now.
Right. We finally found the thing. So anyway, and here's I guess that kind of brings me my third sort of thing, which is the Protestant origin myths. Right. So to accept the Protestant interpretation of this Matthew passage about Peter being the rock, and if you accept that the Protestant interpretation, that's not what it meant,
right?
You know, and again, there's three or four different ways the Protestants will spin it, but if you accept any of those, what you have to believe is that the Lord allowed 15 centuries of Christian men, women, and children to live and believe and die in a false church,
right?
Until Martin Luther came along, you know, and threw an inkwell at the devil and finally got it right.
Right. Yeah. Right.
So, you know, the Lord said, well, yeah, for 15 centuries, all of these men, women, and children are going to die in false churches and a false religion, never knowing salvation. But, you know, that's okay. Years later, Martin Luther will come along and get it right. And then he'll enlist some other guys, except those guys started disagreeing with each other five minutes after they started, right? And because, you know, and Luther didn't get it quite right. He got a little more right. And then there's this endless, you know, Protestant splits and on and on and on, right?
Well, it's the character of Protestantism to protest, right? Like you've said, you know, here's 1500 years of all this, all the great writers, Augustine and all these people, Aquinas and Clement and all these people and all the saints and all of that. And then here comes Martin Luther. He says, you know what? That's not right. I'm, you know what? I know better than everybody. I know better than 1500 years of tradition and history and all these thinkers. I know better than all of them. And every Protestant to this day is equally saying, yeah, I know better. We know
better. Well, at some point you have to kind of just do the, you know, the blink test here and say, wait a minute, just take a breath, blink and say, does that sound like how God operates?
Right.
Did he allow 3/4 of church history, right? 3/4 of the history of the church to be nothing but apostasy and false religion.
Right.
Until Luther or 18 centuries until some American Reformed Baptists or whoever finally figured it out and rescued mankind and the church from darkness.
Right.
Right. That's what you have to believe. That everybody was wrong until we came along. And so I'm not even going to engage in their Greek exegesis because, like I said, the people who were there, nobody understood it that way until now you're coming up with all these ways to disavow it. So, you know, how did I get over this hurdle and how are you working over it, Ed? I guess for me, at the end of the day, I chose the church of history, the church of the ages, because I believe that God is faithful to his people throughout the ages. And so when I got to this point in my own journey, I was like, I've got to find the church of the ages, the church of the origins. Right. I got to go back. And as I investigated, that was the continuous church, the one holy Catholic church. Right after my wife and I converted and we entered the Catholic church through RCA at Easter Vigil, we went to Rome for our 30th anniversary. And when you go there, this is a really coveted tour where you can go below the altar at St. Peter's, 60 feet below that, and see the tomb of Peter. So anyway, I wrote this letter to the Vatican office and said, hey, I was a Protestant minister for 30 years, and I've just converted, and my wife and I are coming for our 30th anniversary, and we would really be meaningful if we could do this. And so anyway, we got in. I actually got to go in on the day of our 30th anniversary. And we went down there, and we got to kneel and pray at the tomb of Peter. And he's there because Peter was executed in a Roman arena where St. Peter's Square stands now. That's why St. Peter's Square is there.
Right.
The Emperor Nero ordered him crucified in front of the crowd. And Peter's last wish was that he wanted to be crucified upside down because he said, I'm not worthy to die in the same manner as my Lord.
Mm.
And I'll tell the story sometime about how they know that that's Peter's tomb, but they do. And I remember on our 30th anniversary, right after we entered the church, being there and praying there and going, I feel like I've come home. You know, I've come home to the church. This is the one holy Catholic and apostolic church. Here lies Peter, the rock upon whom the church was built. And just a mile away or so down the river is the tomb of Paul.
Hmm.
You know, and this is the one holy Catholic and apostolic church. And so, yeah, I guess that's how I got over that hurdle. For me, at the end of the day, I chose the church of the ages, the church of history.
It totally makes sense. In fact, as soon as I was exposed to this way of thinking, as soon as that light shone on my way of thinking, it just dispelled everything hazy, gauzy thoughts about what I thought, you know, the Catholic Church had been, and I realized that I had just sort of gone along with how Martin Luther, the hero, you know, because he was on my team, you know,
Oops.
Woo.
Oop. Ed's crazy. Knocking over
that
stuff
was crazy.
Here. That's crazy stuff is happening here.
Yeah.
But your sweater still looks sharp.
I got all wound up there.
I was going to say something about, you know, fumbly and clumsy, but I'm not because I'm in a compliment.
You're not even going to bring it up.
I'm not even going to bring it up. I'm not even going to bring your clumsiness up because I am in a mode of complimenting my good friend, Ed the Protestant, and being the kind of guy who compliments him.
Such a good friend.
Those are nice pants too.
Yeah. So, yeah. I've worn these every time.
Yeah.
Anyway, I only, yeah.
Yeah. The first time I've, you know, thought to compliment, you know, your outfit. But in any case, hey, thanks for joining us. We are going to be back with another conversation really soon because Kate had some follow-up questions we're going to answer. And if you have questions or stories to share, send them to me at consideringcatholicism@gmail.com. Also visit our website, consideringcatholicism.com. It's real important. Would you rate the podcast? If you're on Spotify or Apple or any other platform, would you give us a rating? That really helps us to move up in searches. It helps to qualify us for new tiers of support. And would you write a review? If you're on Apple Podcasts or you can get on Apple Podcasts, write a review. That also helps us to move up the ladder of visibility and whatnot. And would you consider supporting this ministry? You can do so by clicking the link in the show notes or on our website. And you can give a one-time or recurring donation so that we can help more people to consider Catholicism. So thanks for joining us, and we will be back soon.
All right.